I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Yes, folks. We are moles in the ground, and I'm proud of it, because we moles make history. Passive beasts, not on your life, not on our lives. No, we hunger, we struggle, we organize with others. We struggle for bread, of course, that is the necessities of life. And we struggle for roses, too. Roses meaning love, meaning joy, meaning living together in freedom and dignity. We struggle for our place in the sun and the right to make decisions about our own families and communities, indeed the whole of national life. We balk and resist arbitrary power, and particularly today those who hold economic power and patriarchal power and racist power and power over the so many subordinated groups. Yes, this is still the era of democratic revolution, and all gains have always been contested. So I'm Bill Resnick, your host today on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland every Monday at 9 a.m. Today's Old Mole examines first last Saturday's face-off between this nation's neo-fascists. They were summoned to Portland by a lot of their leaders. And on the other side, there were Portland's various anti-fascist forces. Here's my takeaway. We did pretty good in what will be a long war. Later in the show, a report on climate change and why our national elites refuse to act and are sealing their doom and maybe ours. Also, Jan Hocken interviews Christine Smith, just back from a national convening, on reparations for past injustice and what must precede it. That is an acknowledgement, particularly here in the U.S., an acknowledgement of this nation's racist past and present. And doing that would be part of, yes, making America great. For the first time. Today's music, it's all anti-fascist, a few past anthems, some very modern, from Peggy Seeger, Lead Belly, Billy Gray, Billy Bragg, and Woody Guthrie. First, Peggy Seeger.
Early every year, the seeds are growing. Unseen, unheard, they lie beneath the ground. Would you know? Are showing that with weeds all your garden will abound. If you close your eyes, stop your ears, hold your tongue, then how can you know? For seeds you cannot see may not be there. Seeds you cannot hear may never grow. In January you've still got the choice. You can cut the weeds before they start to bud. If you leave them to grow high, they'll silence your voice, and in December you may pay with your blood. So close your eyes, stop your ears, close your mouth, take it slow.
Well, that's Peggy Seeger in the background, but I'm going to have to tell you the words. It was recorded too low. Basically, the theme is, her song is, early every year the seeds are growing unseen, unheard they lie beneath the ground. Would you know until their leaves are showing that with weeds all your garden will abound? If you close your eyes, stop your ears, hold your tongue, then how can you know? For seeds you cannot see may not be there. The seeds you cannot hear may never grow. In January you still got the choice. That's the song of Peggy Seeger, song of choice. You can cut the weeds before they start to bud. If you leave them to grow high, they'll silence your voice. And in December, you may pay with your blood. That was Peggy Seeger, of course, reminding people of that fascism must be faced early. It can't be ignored, or it can toxify all politics, which is what, in fact, the neo-fascists are intending to do. And they've had some success already in this country. Of course, the question comes how to operate to drive it back into its rotten nests. We'll be talking about that today and in the future. The moles first entered today. It's with Arun Gupta. He's an investigative reporter, a writer, activist based in New York. Spends time here in Portland, a lot of time. Publishes a good deal, including in The Nation, Jacobin, The Intercept, The Washington Post, too. His latest book is Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, a Junk Food Loving Chef's Inquiry into Taste. That'll be coming out later in early next year, I guess. Saturday, he was on assignment covering the face-off between this country's neo-fascists and Portland's various anti-fascist forces. I interviewed him yesterday at the KABU studio. Arun Gupta, welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
This Saturday, Arun Gupta reported from within the neo-fascist and anti-fascist event. Spent most of his time with the neo-fascists as a credentialed reporter, allowed free access through the police lines. Arun, tell us why Saturday's events here were important nationally and even internationally, and give us a sense of the scene and what happened.
So I know this is may sound shocking to some, but the reason people need to be paying attention to what's happening in Portland, especially nationwide, is the extreme right is trying to turn Portland into its terrorist recruiting ground and training ground. So what we saw was extremists coming from all over the country. And by extremists, I mean white nationalists. At least three people were identified Saturday, August 17th, on the far right side, who had been in the deadly Charlottesville Unite the Right rally 2 years ago. In fact, we're pretty much right at the second anniversary of that. There was also members of the American Guard, which is variously described as white supremacists, neo-Nazi, the new Klan. They were there as well. It was mainly Proud Boys, which has become affiliated with violence. Even its founder called it a gang and said, we will kill you. They're known for being Islamophobic, homophobic, misogynist. I think the best description of them is what's called alt-left. They try not to be as overtly racist as neo-Nazis, but they have been linked to all sorts of extreme violent white nationalist movements. And so what they're doing in coming to Portland is trying to use the city to flex their muscle, to engage in violence. And it's essentially, it's a social media strategy. We have to understand kind of the whole context of what's going on here. Portland, liberal Portlandia, is kind of living up to a particular type of image. I often hear a lot of people say, why is this happening in Portlandia? It's supposed to be this quirky, gentle, loving town. And it's just like, well, it's also the whitest big city in America with this history, where Oregon was founded as this white utopia, and where it was illegal for blacks to even move into the state until 1926. This left behind a legacy of white supremacy that continues to this day. With Portland being the whitest big city in America, it's also been for decades, because of that racial homogeneity, a fertile recruiting ground, as the Pacific Northwest is in general, for all sorts of extreme right and white nationalist organizations. So that's the context that creates a weak civilian political leadership that is afraid to challenge its own police force, which has been pretty much colluding with the far right. We've seen great reporting coming out from the Willamette Week, the Portland Mercury, the Guardian, showing through all these internal documents they've gotten from the Portland police, how the police are colluding with, protecting the far right, facilitating their violence, and often then unleashing violence on counter-protesters. So the police are siding with these white nationalists who come out of town against the residents of the very town they're supposed to protect. And then you have a mayor, Ted Wheeler, who was told to me by someone who is he's worked closely with, that the mayor is scared of the police, that the mayor's office is afraid if they push on the police too hard that there'll be a police slowdown or strike. And this is coming from when in the mayor's own inner circle, and that basically there's a bias within the police department of support for Patriot Prayer and white supremacy. So this is why Portland has become the battleground. You know, we have to remember that this is not happening in any other city in the country. The far right keeps trying to go to other places, but they keep getting kicked out of D.C., out of Boston. There was a Proud Boys attack about a year ago in Manhattan where 10 of them were arrested. And in Portland, we've seen very few arrests up until the last couple of weeks. And one of the tragedies is this is because of El Paso. I would argue that the anti-Hispanic pogrom by Patrick Crugius, who released a manifesto using the words and ideas of Donald Trump, killed 22 people on August 4th. And finally, the police are cracking down in Portland, and the feds have also been not cracking down, but turning up the heat a little bit on the far right. So this is the context from what's going on in Portland.
Tell us what happened. They had, 400 to 600 people, which is pretty big for them. On the other hand, this had national and even international press and a number of right-wing talk radio type pundits of the right were promoting it and pushing and asking people to come. They really wanted to have a signature event. It didn't seem to me that they made it. In fact, they sort of slunk away at the end, mostly just going up the Hawthorne Bridge and then asking the police to protect them, go up the Hawthorne Bridge and then take some buses wherever to Vancouver.
Yeah, I think one of the important things to recognize here is this was the largest mobilization of the extreme right so far.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take that many of them to wreak havoc in Portland. We saw that in June 30th, 2018, where they were allowed to engage in just these shocking open brawls, and maybe there were 100-150 of them. So this time I would say there were easily 500 of them. But because of all this fear, and because also the city and the prosecutor finally started clamping down, they started arresting a bunch of these Patriot Prayer guys who orchestrated an attack on Cider Riot, which is a bar on May Day, and they ended up assaulting a woman and fracturing her vertebrae. It took them 3 months, but after the El Paso massacre, the prosecutor and police started finally arresting these Patriot Prayer members. And this had been complete public knowledge. They were live streaming. Andy Ngo was live streaming. He's kind of like the inciter of a lot of this violence. There's a particular strategy also that's going on here. Joey Gibson was even admitted it back in 2016 to Katie Shepard of the Willamette Week, who really deserves a lot of commendation for her outstanding reporting over the years, in that their goal was to try to bait Antifa into getting into violence with the police, whereby that they would get videos that they would use on social media to go viral. And that's exactly what Andy Ngo does. He has a sense for how to take a video and then incite people. And that's what he's been trying to do in Portland in the last year. Basically, whoever he turns his camera or his social media on, it's a significant likelihood that they're going to become targets of harassment and death threats. I talked to 7 different people who he focused on in his work. One should never call him a reporter or a journalist. Basically, at best, he's a provocateur, but really what he does is engage in stochastic terrorism.
Right. But in fact, it seemed to me yesterday they didn't get what they wanted, at least in terms of the antifas in town, who, for whatever reason, spent a good deal of effort making noise. You were with the racists. Did they hear all of the commotion and the clamor in the background?
The guy who led the mob, Joe Biggs, he's affiliated with InfoWars. He had been taking to social media, saying death to Antifa, talking about murdering leftists, this right-wing meme, helicopter rides, which is a reference to how South American military dictatorships, such as Augusto Pinochet, would throw leftists out of helicopters to kill them. He displayed a weapon, this spike bat, that he said he was going to use against Antifa. And so then, about a week beforehand, the FBI finally paid him a visit, and so he got onto social media and we need to tone down the rhetoric and leave those weapons at home. And so social media was just filled with ugly, graphic violence. And this is a big part of what's going on. You know, we have to understand that, you know, the kind of the hollowing out, the in fact, destruction of legacy media, as problematic as it was, it's far better than social media, because social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook, they absolutely do not care what is put on there. And in fact, it's the nature of the media, of social media. You know, it's, Marshall McLuhan is still right. The medium is the message. That kind of the most hyperbolic, dramatic statements are the ones that get paid attention to. And that draws more eyeballs for these platforms. So that's how they get their revenue. So they actually profit from the incitement, the propaganda, the lies that we've seen all these right-wing characters pushing out there. You know, Andy Ngo just being the latest one.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Arun Gupta, who's spent a lot of time in the neo-fascist ranks this Saturday at the event. We're talking about what happened there. He discussed, in fact, the change in the behavior of the police in Portland and, the FBI. They're starting to take right-wing violence maybe seriously. Arun, let's discuss whether this is really a serious change in their behavior, or is this a sort of tactical thing that they're doing? The right wing is, in fact, trying to infiltrate every part of the U.S. quote, public safety and security apparatus.
Exactly. The FBI had a report about this. You know, The Intercept has really been the publications that's been on top of a lot of this, where they said the white supremacists are infiltrating law enforcement. But, you know, the other issue is that law enforcement, it starts with slave patrols in the South. In the North, it began as anti-union militias. First, it was about catching runaway slaves and often instituting violent justice on the spot. Then they were enforcing Jim Crow laws, apartheid, for basically a century. So white supremacy is baked into police departments. Then there's also a sociocultural affinity. You know, you're talking about aggressive, violent white men who are tend to be misogynistic. And so it doesn't matter who a particular officer is. You know, it doesn't matter that Chief Daniel Outlaw is a black woman. That is completely irrelevant. It's the institution that is rotten to the core. And so we've finally seen some movement. And, you know, I pose this question to Christian Williams, author of Our Enemies in Blue, Policing and Power in America. And he, I think, really nailed what's going on. And what we see is that historically, police allow extreme right violence a lot of latitude. And then some threshold is crossed. And then they finally start to pay attention. But in the end, the law enforcement agencies will allow that extreme right violence to continue far longer and to cause far more damage than it will to the left. So in the 1960s, when Northern white college students start to be killed, so since during the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Summer in 1964, the FBI starts paying attention to the Klan. In the 1980s, when violent white supremacists start a campaign of bank robberies and targeted assassinations, such as the radio talk show host Alan Berg, then the government starts paying attention to the Order and, you know, other violent white supremacists who are based in the Pacific Northwest. In the 1990s, after Timothy McVeigh bombs Oklahoma City and kills 168 people, then the government finally starts paying attention to the right-wing militias. So the problem, though, at this point, is it's not like you even have any sort of commitment to bourgeois democracy that you would have under past Republican presidents. Now what we see is Donald Trump. 2 weeks after El Paso, we have to remember, again, one of the really just horrendous things about El Paso in terms of the cause and effect was the right stopped talking about making Antifa a domestic terrorist organization. There is actually no such designation equivalent to the State Department's list, but Ted Cruz and other Republicans had been pushing it, and suddenly they went silent after El Paso. Now Donald Trump has started up again, but of course it's going to be harder to do now because obviously everyone is finally, especially the liberal media, is finally starting to acknowledge the real threat is white nationalist terrorists and these pro-Trump terrorists that he's creating by inciting them through mass communications. And this is what's known as stochastic terrorism.
Arun, thanks a lot for talking to us. We sort of have come to the end of the time. One final thing. It does seem to me, though, that in all of those instances that you listed, when the police and the FBI began going after them, they were responding to, and the whole civil rights movement was that story, the cooperation with the Klan all over the South until public opinion became so strong that Kennedy and the others had to step in, force the FBI to do something because it was undermining his presidency at the time. It seems to me that an overwhelming response by the public for insisting on some kind of constitutional government will, in fact, change police behavior to some extent.
Sure. And you know, let me just finish with this point. So one can say after August 17th that it showed the Portland law enforcement agencies have the capacity to control the streets, which is what they're supposed to do when you have these violent right-wing extremists coming to town. But that begs the question, why did it take them over 2 years to do this?
We'll answer that another time, Arun. It was really good talking to you. Thanks a lot.
It was good talking to you too, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
There's a great and a bloody fight around this whole world tonight. In the battle, the bombs and shrapnel rain. Hitler told the world around he would tear our union down, but our union's gonna break them slavery chains. And our union's gonna break them slavery chains. I walked up on a mountain in the middle of the sky, could see every farm and every town. I could see all the people in this whole wide world.
Okay, that was Woody Guthrie's song, Tear the Fascists Down. He was singing, imploring U.S. North Americans, really begging the people of the United States to enter World War II, which they were resisting at the time when he was writing the song, begging Americans to begin seeing Nazi Germany as a threat to them and to any possibility of decent government in the world. Ultimately, of course, the U.S. did enter World War II. Stay tuned on The Mole for a discussion of doing justice for groups that have been enslaved and murdered through the U.S. past and continuing. What must be done, including reparations and including an end to discrimination and including truth-telling. Next on The Mole, I interviewed Christian Parenti on saving the planet from global warming. Christian Parenti, welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Christian Parenti is a writer, teacher, agitator, teaches at John Jay College of the City University of New York. He's written a good deal on climate change, including the book Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. In it, he examined the parts of the world already hard hit by climate change and vast suffering and outmigration, wars for resources, food, and water that will get worse. Today we'll be discussing mostly what has to be done to stop global roasting and ensure that the human experiment continues. Christian, first let's discuss the gravity of the threats to human life and what's standing in the way of serious action.
The gravity of the threat can't be underestimated, understated, you know. Jim Hansen, in his book, Storms of My Grandchildren, laid out the what he calls the Venus scenario. I mean, the long-term thing is that basically, you know, all life on Earth could be made extinct by the continual heating of the planet, because as the climate system collapses and unravels, climate change can become self-propelling. So, for example, you know, as the boreal forests die, they release more CO2 into the atmosphere, which accelerates warming. So, right, the symptom of warming adds to the cause, and this compounds to the point where the planet could become like Venus, and the oceans could boil off. This is by Hansen's calculation. If just business as usual and self-compounding runaway climate change were unchecked, you know, it would take like 2,000 years. But in 2,000 years, it's conceivable that, you know, the oceans could boil off, and we would have the atmosphere like Venus. However, there is also, I met a young scientist not too long ago who pointed out something rather strange out, amazingly, is that many of the main, like 14 main climate models don't assume or don't calculate the end of these positive feedback loops, like positive not in any kind of moral sense, but just in a kind of physical sense. A positive feedback loop is where the cause, greenhouse gases being trapped in the atmosphere, trapping heat that comes in from the sun, not letting it back out, that's the primary cause. It leads to the melting of Arctic ice. The melting of Arctic ice makes the ocean surface darker because, you know, the ice is no longer there to reflect the sunlight back. And then so then that result of warming feeds back upon the original causation, i.e. making the planet even hotter by absorbing more energy from the sun. So a lot of these feedback loops don't last forever. There's a certain a moment of increase, and then it stops. I mean, the boreal forest would die and burn, and emit, but then eventually that stops. I don't think the question of the Venus syndrome is completely solved. But anyway, that's pretty far off in the future, and regardless of whether all life gets wiped out or not, human civilization is in for a very, very rough ride, because pending sea level rises, I mean, it's already happening. We've seen like a half inch of sea level rise just since 1972. So it's a very, very serious problem. It threatens agriculture. It threatens our urbanized coastlines. I mean, this is a global civilization connected through coastal cities. So you can imagine just the financial and economic repercussions, the collapse of supply chains that urban coastal flooding alone could cause. Never mind the desiccation and flooding of agricultural areas and breadbaskets. So it's a serious threat. Why are we not dealing with it, you ask? I mean, I think it's pretty straightforward. It's pretty simple. It's that the fossil fuel industry is fantastically wealthy and highly politicized and has invested millions of dollars in disinformation. Noam Ariensky's book, Merchants of Doubt, is superb on tracking this history. And there's other reasons we could get into, you know, denial, this, that. But I think the primary reason why more hasn't been done is because the industry that is most threatened by dealing with climate change, the fossil fuel industry, has invested very heavily and very assiduously in distorting the facts and trying to convince citizens at large and politicians in particular and the pundit class that there really is no problem, that we don't quite know if this is as bad a situation as in fact we do know that the climate crisis is very bad.
Well, it seems to me there's another part of it, though, which is the elites of politics, in order for them to keep getting elected and have safe seats and live well and retire into great amounts of honor and take jobs then in the regulated industries later, they all depend on, every political elite depends on growth, right? They depend on a successful capitalist economy that has to keep growing.
I mean, before we were on air, you and I were talking briefly about a kind of unjust transition. I don't actually think it's necessarily the case that dealing with climate change translates into degrowth. That maybe that should happen, but in the short term, there's a lot of jobs and a lot of profit and a lot of growth that could be had for politicians who were bold enough to try and euthanize the fossil fuel industry and build out a new energy, clean energy sector. I mean, that's a massive project of investment and construction and employment. So there's a lot of growth. They don't want to go up against powerful interests because they need the money to get reelected. You know, their brains have been ideologically marinating in a kind of careerist liberalism and opportunism from, you know, their Ivy League educations on through. You know, they don't only miseducate the masses, they miseducate themselves, right? Elites are high on their own supply. They believe their own market solutions.
In addition, it seems to me, though, that they've decided, that is, the whole capitalist class and the politicians who listen to them and depend on them, at least in the short run. I mean, it's true that a Green New Deal would be a tremendous boost for ordinary people's income, combined with, let's say, a universal coverage and health care. And politicians who managed, who were responsible for that, would become immensely popular, like Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal Coalition for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. But in the period of transition, when capital is fighting all that and wants to keep control, they don't want to lose control. Even in World War II, they fought the government's efforts to sort of nationalize the auto industry and the airplane industry that they built and the others, but they didn't want to lose control. And I think all capitalist interests, that's major to them.
They live in fear of the slippery slope. First, you tell us we can't burn oil and that we have to build solar panels. What's next? You take away all our money? And the answer is, yeah, potentially.
And they will fight, and the transition period is going to be very tough for any politician, so they just go along to get along.
That's why we got to elect Bernie. Why we got to get Bernie through the primary. I'm convinced Bernie can win the general election. I think the primary, much, much harder. That's probably tepid social democratic politics by your estimation, I would guess, Bill. But
no, there's a left social democracy.
Okay, he's not as radical as many on the left would like, but, you know, I think it's time for people to wake up and get realistic about what the parameters of social change actually are.
Yes, and once it starts, it could well continue. People are sort of socialists in so many ways, as you point out. We have a some way socialized state. It's a socialized state, though, helping capitalists deliver.
It's socialism for the rich and socialism for the polluters.
Yes.
But it is very socialistic. Capital cannot survive without the state, its life support system. 2008 is the perfect example, right? You had all of these right-wing ideologues in the Bush administration who had spent their entire lives degrading the public sector and venerating the market, et cetera, et cetera. And then when the global economy starts to melt down at unprecedented scale, they were forced, all of them, to just shelve their ideology, which they had been deeply committed to their entire adult lives, and basically intervene in the economy in a massive, massive way. And that was a moment of very robust socialism. There was, unfortunately, no social justice attached to it, right? So the banks were bailed out. The entire global financial system was bailed out by the U.S. state. And it had to be, or there would have been economic catastrophe. And one of the many great tragedies is that we didn't get anything for that, right? We didn't get, like, any nationalized banks. We didn't get any kind of orders imposed on the financial sector to fund, 10% a year of all their investment, clean energy conversion, or any commitments to, you know, jobs programs, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a moral failure, but it reveals something technically, which is capitalism cannot and does not exist without a kind of hidden in plain sight socialism.
And government regulation and some limits on their predation. And now, of course, there's the environment, though, and that is about to consume our experiment in, quote, civilization. Time for a station break. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Hour on KBOO, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Christian Parenti, a teacher, activist, agitator. He's written a great deal on climate change. He's now working on a book on how any capitalist economy must rely on vast support from government to survive. So far today, we've discussed the vast threat of climate change and why the capitalist elite, particularly those in the U.S., have torpedoed all efforts to take the massive necessary action. One final thing, Christian. The capitalist elite and the politicians seem to have, from my point of view, I think, do recognize the reality of climate change. Now, the fossil fuel industry just wants to profit as long as it possibly can. But they all think that, in fact, we are so ingenious and our technologies are so wonderful and what we've developed over the past few years, thanks actually to all kinds of government investment in research and procurement and all of the ways, the airplane industry, the computer industry, all those things where the U.S. leads the world is a product of public monies.
Exactly right.
And also, of course, in some kinds of individual entrepreneurism and development, there have been huge incentives for people to, in fact, work on all those projects in public universities, of course, and also just the whole educational system, which in comparison to almost all the rest of the world is very democratic in that it is universal and poor people aren't just shunted into manual work right away. So there's this there was at least this upward mobility. That's another matter. But I think they believe that, in fact, our technologies, and there's been this period in the United States of such rapid technological development that has changed everything, at least the way we live and think.
Right. There's a techno fetishism that leads to a kind of idiotic optimism. It's just like, oh, well, you know, yeah, when the crisis comes, we'll just apply technology. But that's pretty diluted because, I mean, it's not entirely wrong because, I mean, at another level, like, we have the technology we need, so the problem isn't breakthrough. It isn't like we have to invent something new. The problem is one of political economic transformation. How do we scale up this technology? And that's a problem of investment and planning and political coordination, enhancing the power of the public sector. And as you know, we were talking about before, I mean, the capitalist class has a, I think, actually kind of rational fear of the slippery slope. First, the planning department tells us where to build and what to build. Where does it stop next? Like expropriation? And the answer is, yeah, possibly, you know. And that blinds elites to the fact that really we don't need some silver bullet new technology. What we need are policies to build out a massive clean energy infrastructure, rebuild the grid, also prepare for retreat from the coastlines. We have incredibly toxic coastlines, right? We have to like move atomic waste and chemical plants back from these coastlines. Otherwise, you know, we worry about what the sea will do to our urban coastlines. We have to also think about, well, what will like the toxicity of our urban coastlines do to the sea when it comes and consumes them, consumes all the landfills, et cetera, et cetera.
You've talked about, we have all the technologies now, and then you have identified them, renewable energy, public transit, regenerative agriculture, and reforestation. I'm not sure if that's a new technology, but we can do all of those things. We have all the tools, but we're not using those tools. But those are not the tools that they want to use. They want to continue with their deforestation and agribusiness and even fossil fuel use, because they think that we will develop these great machines, small, cheap, easy to build, that will suck up all of that carbon, all the greenhouse gas emissions, and bury them somewhere deep in the earth where it won't escape for a million years.
Well, actually, you know, I think that carbon capture and sequestration or carbon dioxide removal, I think that is actually a very important technology. And what's interesting about it is the total impossibility of market forces bringing it to scale. I mean, there's no market for this. It's like the public sector has to deploy this technology, and it exists, and it's kind of insane that we have the capacity to draw down CO2 artificially, and we're incapable of deploying it because, like, Climeworks is one of the main companies behind this stuff. And if you read their literature, it's like, yeah, we're going to strip CO2 to the atmosphere, and we're going to sell it to beverage manufacturers and this and that. And it's like, what? You think there's going to be a market for all of this CO2 that comes out? No.
You know, we drink a lot of soda pop.
It's a form of infrastructure that civilization and capitalism needs to survive. And, you know, everything that capital needs to survive can't be provided by capital. Thus, the state always exists, and there's always this hidden socialism subsidizing and supporting and reproducing capitalism. And as with roads, capital needs roads, but they can't coordinate to have private roads. I mean, the history of early America was full of the failures, essentially, of private roads. There were lots of private roads, and they basically didn't develop fast enough, and they were too expensive, and it didn't work, and it held back economic development. And so only the creation of public roads unleashed the private sector to develop at the pace it was capable of. And similarly with this climatological infrastructure of carbon dioxide removal, there's no way the private sector can ever bring this to scale. And I think that one problem that a lot of Greens have is there's kind of a reaction to the right-wing techno-fetishism is a kind of left-green technophobia. We're going to have to use big forms of technology to solve this problem if we're going to solve it.
Christian Parenti, this is the end of our part one of the interview. We've concluded that the risks of human extinction are enormous, that in fact at the state now, which is absolutely essential in the national state and local states, they're absolutely essential for making the transition to a society that preserves the ecosystems upon which life depends. We'll be talking in our second part of our interview about who will take control of that state when climate change keeps getting worse and finally the people awaken to mend action, and what kinds of technologies are going to be supported, and what kinds of industry and how we do food production and transport ourselves and communicate and live in cities. You see the need for a variety of kinds of technologies. The question is, under whose direction would those be used? And we'll be talking about that next in the second part of this interview. Christian Parenti, thanks so much for talking to us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
That was Christian Parenti. We're going to play a Lead Belly song in a few seconds. It's called part of our anti-fascist music festival here on the Old Mole Variety Hour. Four songs. Billy Bragg is be coming up. So first, though, Lead Belly.
Either started out in 1932. When he started out, he took it home from the Jew. We're gonna tear it down. We're gonna tear it down. We're gonna tear it down someday. We're gonna bring him to the ground. We're gonna bring him to the ground. We're gonna bring him to the ground someday. When he started out, he took the juice.
That was Lead Belly with Mr. Hitler. This is Jan Hawken talking this morning with Christine Schmidt, a social worker and psychoanalyst from Brooklyn, and active in the reparations movement. Schmidt organizes and teaches groups on racial literacy for white professionals and is a member of Psychoanalysis for Social Responsibility. Welcome to KBOO, Christine Schmidt.
Thank you very much for having me, Jan. What a pleasure.
Well, you recently participated in a national grassroots reparations convening in Ferguson, and also have been involved in both the material side of the reparations campaign as well as the interpersonal or psychological aspects of that same moral responsibility to address not only the legacy of the Atlantic slave trade, but ongoing up to the present trauma and suffering and exploitation of Black people in this country. Let's start with that gathering in Ferguson. Can you tell us something about it and what you drew from it?
Absolutely. It was last week from August 8th through the 11th. It was a convening that was brought together by the Truth Telling Project under the sponsorship of Fellowship for Reconciliation, or affiliated with, I think is the proper way of saying that. And there were many, many grassroots activists brought together and a number of families who were victims of police violence because they had lost a child, in most cases a son, to police violence. And the reparations convening also coincided with the fifth year anniversary of Mike Brown's murder by police in Ferguson. And so besides the panels and the healing that happened over the 4 days that we were all together, we also participated in a memorial for Mike Ferguson and for all of the families who have lost children to racist police violence. So that was the setting. I am a white identified person, psychoanalyst, social worker, and was there with a colleague, also white identified. And it was a very humbling experience for us to be invited in what felt very much like a healing space for Black activists and people who have suffered directly from the racial terrorism and racial violence in this country. But I also have to say that in the course of my being there, it became clear and clear to me how the cost that I have paid and we white identified folks have paid for whiteness is very much in need of healing, and that we have carried in our bodies and spirits the effects of what it's like to be from a perpetrator group. So it was a very expansive experience in looking at the trauma and all the different paths for healing and repair.
You're saying that part of this focus on the psychological effects of exploitation and oppression, including forms of trauma as well as other forms of harm, are effects realized by victims of oppression, but also by their perpetrators. And I think this has always been the two sides of liberation movements, that the oppressor is paradoxically liberated in some respects by a movement. But there's also potential shift toward the perpetrators of, or the beneficiaries of, racial violence. And how do you manage those two sides of the psychological effects of, and the psychological demands of the reparation movement, of staying mm-hmm. focused on the suffering of Black people through this history and listening and learning and responding mm-hmm. while at the same time recognizing how all people are impoverished by this same history?
Yeah, well, Jan, I think you used two words that really just resonate so big. Listening, I'll say that again, listening, and learning. And listening on, and this is maybe where we bring our psychoanalytic selves into it, listening on many different levels, not only listening to the words, but listening to what is also happening unconsciously. And that's something that, we could learn through our bodies, we could learn through our hearts, but really, I can give you a concrete example from last week. As I became aware of moments where I was feeling anxious or angry or, I mean, a whole array of emotions, instead of reacting to it or shutting that down, I really had to try and listen to what was making me uncomfortable to see if I could bring it up to a more conscious level so I could look at it.
And this is your own internal work.
That kind of listening is so important.
Yeah, there's an internal process of self-reflection in sitting in those groups.
There really is, and I think, I'll throw some terms out, and if you want me to pause and maybe talk a little bit about them, but the white fragility, the defensiveness that white people often fall into when we're presented with racial information is a way that we shut down and shut off and then and don't allow that the deep listening to come in. So, and I am so aware of when that operates in me. I mean, I feel that that rises up. So, that's a kind of deep listening that I do with myself when I'm in a group where I'm feeling kind of moving in and out of the discomfort.
Isn't a certain amount of defensiveness, though, part of how humans are psychologically prepared to get through life? That I think of invoking guilt or using guilt in a group is sort of like salt. It has a place. It's vital, but it should be used sparingly. And if the entire focus is on arousing guilt and the providing space for people to bring the history of their suffering and harms into the moment, that there is something perhaps to be useful about the psychoanalytic idea of transference and countertransference, that people bring histories not of their own making into those rooms, and not everything is measure for measure warranted by
that's right. And so it's very
what's going on in that moment.
yes. And when I can recognize that at a moment in a room that I am in my white body, that I am representing whiteness and white perpetrators, that's really helpful for me to know.
Right. And that it's not all about you. You know, or us, yeah. You know, that people will react out of their histories. And I think there's something helpful about that idea that, at least for me, helps reduce some defensiveness, that I might have said something insensitive I need to attend to. But we bring in histories where we carry these signifiers of past histories. And when you open up these spaces, you're the recipient of histories that
absolutely
are not entirely all of your own making. But that's, I think, a useful aspect of psychoanalysis, is helping us to be aware of how unconsciously we evoke so much for one another.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, in a way, it can, that concept of transference, countertransference, and knowing that we're evoking something just in how we walk into a room, can help us tolerate some of the discomfort so that we are open to learning. And I think that that's a really helpful way to be able to sit with discomfort and know that, oh, this is stuff that I'm bringing in with me as kind of an inheritance and a legacy, and that I could tolerate sitting in a place with that representation so that I can engage with other people.
And before we close, I'd like you to speak a little about how you ground the psychological dimensions of racism and the fractured relationships and oppressive aspects of daily life with the material conditions that are so central to the reparations campaign. How do you combine them, and do you think the focus on the psychological has a risk of moving away from the material conditions of this same history?
Yeah, I think that is a danger, a possibility, and at the same time, I think that the focusing only on the psychological atonement, apologies, and repair without tending to the material is also a danger, right? And so...
Right, that was the danger I was trying to get at, right? You nailed it, yeah.
Yeah, and so what we are looking at, and what I have so appreciated the grassroots reparation convening, is trying to look at material of emotional, spiritual, at many different aspects that have to be addressed all at once, and that there isn't a single route or a single path for doing that, but many different routes that again happen all at once. And so I feel like, and this was another big takeaway from the convening, that the complexity of the conversations about reparations have just begun. That it is not only about material repair, but it also can't only be about the psychological healing. And where white America has a huge responsibility, particularly in the material and wealth inequality that we have created and reaped.
And I think that's a good place to close today, and I hope to have you on the show again, others from Psychoanalysis for Social Responsibility, to continue with this incredibly important work in the reparations movement.
Well, thank you.
This is Jan Hocken talking today with Christine Schmidt, a psychoanalyst from New York City, about the psychodynamics of the reparations movement. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Jan. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred.
Well, we've come to the end of the show, and we had to cut Billy Bragg a little bit. That's a great song, All You Fascists. He's, and in that song, Billy Bragg was identifying fascism as a broad range of behaviors, the racists and misogynists. He warns them, you are bound to lose. And this is a quote from one of his verses, people of every color marching side by side. And that is the way to stop the fascists. So we are signing off. Thanks to Arun Gupta, Christian Parenti, Christine Schmidt, to our musicians today, and Jan Hocken, of course, who interviewed Christine Schmidt. To our musicians today, Peggy Seeger, Woody Guthrie, Leadbelly, Billy Braggs. To our engineer today, Tammy Dean. All the mistakes were mine, the little bits of dead air. Anyway, thanks to all of you out there who support this station, and since we live stream and archive everything, all 24 hours a day of programming, we get support from all over the planet. Finally, you can hear the show or any part of it again or any of our previous shows, or recommend us to your friends. Tell them to go on the web to KABU and go to the top
Michael
right,
Barton.
The search box, and type Old Mole or Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show should be up very soon, by tomorrow, maybe even this afternoon. Join us again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Moles Under Brown perspective. I'm Bill Resnick, your host today, signing off. See you next Monday at 9. And one final thing, if you haven't done it yet, go to the KABU homepage and join KABU and become a member. Thanks a lot.